Surfers may get a saint from Brazil. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's Wednesday, February 25th. Today, the story of Guido Schaefer, a Brazilian doctor and surfer who may be headed for sainthood.
Guido used to say that Jesus was really the first surfer because he was the first to walk on the water.
Interesting theory. Also, a rule change lets the spouses of H-1B visa holders get their own jobs. Great news for this H-1B wife.
I can be my real self. I will no longer be my husband's wife only.
Plus, a bike ride down Bolivia's road of death. It's not for the faint of heart or head, as one cyclist found out.
He was bleeding. He was alive. He crashed. He broke the wrist. And the bike hit the forehead.
Those stories ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Second Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, the new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nighy, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere March 6th.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. The last time I was at the airport, I ended up in a long line again. For me, for most of us, I imagine those airport lines are our main contact with the Department of Homeland Security. The TSA is their agency. But there's a whole lot more to DHS than that, and we could be about to find out just which parts of the giant department are essential and which are not. That's what's at stake in the showdown on Capitol Hill over the DHS budget. Democrats and Republicans could still end up burying their differences on immigration and pass a new funding bill for the DHS. So let's take this moment to understand a little better the Department of Homeland Security.
It's the child of 9/11, so to speak.
That's Juliette Kayyem, a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. She says essential DHS employees would continue to work even through a shutdown.
There's about 300,000 employees who are your Border Patrol agents, your emergency managers, your TSA screeners. They are viewed as essential because they are part of America's enforcement powers. So they will continue to work, but because they are deemed essential, they will not get paid. Now, for most people listening, they'll eventually get paid if we do come to this shutdown. Mm. A small percentage of DHS employees will be furloughed, meaning don't come to work, you're non-essential.
So immigrant detention centers and undocumented immigrants facing deportation, these are not essential tasks?
They are essential in the sense that they will be held, that people aren't going to be released. And that's sort of the phoniness of this shutdown is most of how we encounter the department, we're still going to encounter them, whether you're an immigrant in detention, whether you're traveling at an airport, or you're the president and the Secret Service is protecting your family. Mm. All of those pieces are going to be deemed essential. Those people just won't be paid. Most, I think I saw a number, 50 or 60% of DHS employees earn less than $30,000. This is not the 1%. And so even a short delay in a paycheck is going to impact a couple hundred thousand families across the United States. It's just an unfair way to treat employees of the federal government who are on our front lines protecting us at a time when terrorism, snowstorms.
Well, I was going to say it's a pretty macabre time for political theater because we've got threats to major shopping malls, ISIS looming large, and politicians in Washington are now going to fold those into a fight over the budget for Homeland Security. It's kind of odd.
It's sort of immature is the way I look at it. I mean, most Americans probably don't have a good attitude about the department, mostly because our encounter with them is
At the airport, TSA.
But the failure to pay these employees will be felt in ways that most people don't know. It's the small business owner in Boston who is seeking federal relief because their roof collapsed because of 4 feet of snow. Mm. I mean, it is the shipping captain whose boat is stuck because the Coast Guard is not able to get out there or break up ice as soon as possible. So that's sort of how people should remember and think about the department. It is a lot bigger. It is integrated into the fiber of the homeland, so to speak, and state and local governments. And that is why you're starting to see mayors and governors speak up about not having the shutdown.
DHS has an Office of Intelligence and Analysis, and employees there say it turns out intelligence spam and produces almost nothing you can't find on Google. What do you make of that assessment? I mean, is that like one area that could be cut?
Yes, absolutely. I have been public about this. I never understood why the department has its own intelligence agencies. And what you've seen over time and through four cabinet secretaries now is an attempt to focus its lane, so to speak. What is it good at and what is it better at? than other agencies. So you can't compete with the Department of Defense. It's too big. It's been around too long. The Department of Justice has investigations and prosecutions. So what you've seen over time is it focusing on border, emergency management, and cyber. Those are sort of the three lanes that it's beginning to, I would say, get its wings. So I sort of say, you know, you got to give it, you know, another 20 or 30 years, so to speak. The Department of Defense took a long time to find its lane.
Juliette Kayyem is a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. She's now a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School. The fact that this budget crisis was sparked by differences over immigration, well, that is not good news for immigrants in the long run. But here's some news that a large number of spouses of immigrants are excited about. Now, the U.S. admits some 85,000 H-1B visa holders each year. These are highly skilled immigrants. Many work in the tech sector. A lot of them bring their spouses along, and they receive H-4 visas. Until now, H-4 visa holders were not allowed to work in the U.S., but yesterday the Obama administration announced a visa rule revision for these spouses. Neha Mahajan is excited about this news. She's the wife of an H-1B visa holder. She lives in New Jersey. Tell us what this revision says and how it's going to affect you, Neha.
So, Marco, basically, this revision would now let me get an EAD, which is an employment authorization document, because of which I can now get into the market, look for jobs, or maybe open my own business. I can also go out and start studying, which I could not earlier because nobody would give me a student loan because I don't have an SSN. I literally do not have an identity here in the U.S. because I am dependent on my spouse. And when they gave me H-4 visa, they made sure I was dependent in the real sense.
So how are you feeling about this? I mean, is it as big as, like, I now have kind of an identity here in the U.S.?
Absolutely. I can be my real self. I will no longer be my husband's wife only. I can go out, open up my bank account. I can open my own business if I want to. I can go and study if I want to. I mean, I'm not restricted anymore to be just a homemaker.
How soon will you begin looking for work? And tell me what you do.
I came in the U.S. about 7 years ago. And before coming to the U.S., I was a television news reporter doing pretty well. And I'd taken a break because I just had a baby at that point. And when I was just about thinking of getting back to work, my husband's company decided to send him to the U.S. on this project. Well, I was just too happy to come down and accompany him because, after all, America is the land of dreams. When I came here, somebody did remark that, you know, you'll not be allowed to work. And, you know, I was really very positive. I'm a positive person. So I thought, you know, I'm sure there must be a way around for that. Soon after entering the U.S., I contacted a few people in the media section here, you know, and they told me quite honestly that, you know, it's just not possible. Without a work permit, you will not be allowed to work here. Absolutely no. Nobody would sponsor my H-1 because I am not a technical person. I do not come from a technical background. I'm not a software engineer. So nobody would sponsor my H-1 and nobody would even let me intern. So my only hope was to volunteer, to keep myself alive, to keep my skills and my education and my talent alive. So I have volunteered for an organization here in New Jersey that hosts an annual film festival. And that's pretty much what I have done.
There are estimates that as many as 179,000 spouses could apply for work permits this year. When people say, oh, you, Neha, and other immigrant spouses will be taking away jobs from Americans, how do you reply?
I am soon to be an American citizen, as I can call it, because I did come as an immigrant. But right now, I am in the process of becoming an American citizen. We've already applied for a green card. I am your neighbor. I live in the same neighborhood. I pay my taxes, even though I don't earn. I pay my taxes. I won't be taking any jobs from you. I may be, you know, I may just become an entrepreneur and will be opening up my own business if I was allowed, which I am now. So I'm not just here to take away jobs.
I'm just curious, do you know if many immigrant spouses who will now benefit from this revision on the visa rule, will they ultimately stay here permanently?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the only beneficiaries of this law are those who have already applied for green cards, which is the way to become a citizen.
Mm. Neha Mahajan lives in New Jersey. She's one of many spouses of highly skilled immigrants who will now be able to work legally in the United States. Thank you, Neha, for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco.
Here's another immigrant who's celebrating today. He's 19-year-old Joan Moncada, a baseball phenom from Cuba. And it looks like he's about to sign with our very own Boston Red Sox. Yeah, we outbid the Yankees for him. Take that, New York. Moncada is coming to Boston as a lot of people talking about the thaw in U.S.-Cuban relations and whether this is a sign of signings to come. No one in the newsroom is looking forward more to the start of the baseball season than the world's very own Clark Boyd.
Yeah, Marco, man, speaking of thaws, isn't it great to imagine a time when there is not 8 feet of snow on the ground and they can actually get out there and play ball?
That can happen?
Yeah, so they tell me.
So tell me more about Joan Moncada. Who is he?
By all accounts, the kid is an incredible baseball player. If I can just read one sports writer's description of him. Moncada is a brutishly athletic player, a baseball player masquerading in a linebacker's body.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, okay. So he plays middle infield. Rumor has it that he can do second base. He can do shortstop, even third base if you ask him to. And he's a switch hitter, so he can hit from both sides of the plate for power. So you can see why the Red Sox, among other teams, are interested in him.
So this is with the backdrop of the whole thaw with Cuba. I mean, most Cuban players you hear about in the major leagues are defectors, but not Moncada, not this time.
He actually was playing for Cienfuegos, which is where he's from in Cuba, and he got permission. He got a passport and a visa to travel to Guatemala. So not only did the Cuban state let him out of the country legally, but the Cuban Baseball Commission basically let him go. So when he gets to Guatemala, he waits there for a while, and then he basically petitions for free agency for the major leagues. So to me, the big thing that's being signaled here, the real thaw, is that Cuban baseball was willing to let him go. In the past, they will just not let those players go, which is why players have defected.
Yeah. I mean, the embargo, we should say, is still in place, but this thaw is starting to feel real. I mean, a number of musical acts have now gone down to Cuba since Obama's announcement. Conan O'Brien just got back from taping a bunch of episodes of his show in Havana. Do you think this Moncada purchase signals a whole new area in U.S.-Cuban baseball relations?
Well, I do. And it's obviously, as with everything with U.S.-Cuba, it's going to take a while for it to play out. But, you know, even on the Cienfuegos team that Moncada was playing for, there are probably four or five other players that the major leagues would love to snap up. I mean, that is the idea anyway is that the island is just teeming with baseball talent, untapped baseball talent, and that if they dangle enough money out in front of their faces, they're all going to want to come and play in the majors. You know, the downside of this will be, what does that mean for Cuban baseball in the long run if all of the best players come here? You know, will Major League Baseball end up setting up training facilities in Cuba the way they've set up training facilities in the Dominican or to some extent even in Venezuela? Will they make an investment in developing that homegrown talent in Cuba the way they have in other places in Latin America? And I think it's just way too early to say whether that's going to happen or not.
And for Joan Moncada, what does his first year with the Red Sox look like?
Well, look, they spent a lot of money on this kid. He is 19 years old. He is still young. He is still green. He still does not have major league experience. So everything that I'm reading says he's going to spend 1 year in the minor leagues to start with anyway. As a Boston Red Sox baseball fan, I'd say maybe they should have spent that money on pitching and not on, you know, a middle infielder. But, you know, what are you going to do? I think what the Red Sox have said is that this is an investment in the future of the team. It's basically like buying a first-round draft pick 2 years from now. Hopefully he'll pan out. And if not, well, there's certainly, you know, he's certainly going to be worth something in a trade for the team. But I'd say for the first year, the kid's going to be spending a lot of time in places like Pawtucket.
The world's Clark Boyd. We'll see you at Fenway. Thanks.
Play ball, Marco.
And one more sports note from Boston before we take a break. A few months back, we did a story here on The World about newly discovered species and how some are named after famous people. You remember the water mite named after Jennifer Lopez or a slime mold beetle named after Dick Cheney? Now the latest, a tiny wasp discovered in Kenya, has been named in honor of the star Boston Bruins goalie Tuukka Rask from Finland. This new species is called T. tuukkaraski. Turns out that the scientific team that made the discovery included an entomologist from Newton, Mass., just down the road from me, and he is a big Bruins fan. No surprise there. Also, the research that led to the discovery of the new species was partially funded by the government of Finland. This is The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. The FBI has a most wanted list, but it also has sub-lists, like the violent crimes list, the crimes against children list. And the most wanted guy among cyber criminals is a Russian named Evgeny Bogachev. The FBI is offering $3 million as a bounty. Brian Bennett has been following the story for the Los Angeles Times. So just who is this guy, Bogachev?
So Bogachev is one of the most sophisticated cyber criminals in the world, and the FBI has been chasing this guy for at least 8 years, since 2007, when he launched a massive botnet where he created a malicious piece of software that was able to infect hundreds of thousands of computers and siphon off bank account passwords. And the FBI says that he was able to take at least $100 million out of U.S. bank accounts using this software over the last 8 years.
And that was the deed that made him a $3 million fugitive?
That and other things. He also created this really insidious virus called CryptoLocker. And what this thing does is when it gets in your computer, it locks up your hard drive and you have to pay a bounty to the hackers in order to get it unlocked.
Yeah, we actually covered that kind of malware a couple of weeks ago on The World. Is his version still active and working?
The FBI says that CryptoLocker is not as effective as it used to be, but that it still infects several thousand computers around the world.
So the FBI has been looking for Bogachev for 7 years. Why can't they find him? Do they have no idea where he lives or hiding out?
No, that's the amazing thing about this story is that Bogachev is apparently living in the open in Russia in a resort town on the Black Sea. And the FBI knows exactly where he is, but the Russian authorities don't appear to be going out of their way to arrest him.
So he's somewhere out on the Black Sea. Is he a yachtsman or something?
So Bogachev apparently likes boats, and he lives in this beach town on the Black Sea near Crimea and likes to go out sailing on his yacht. And the FBI says that he could probably be seen at numerous Russian resort towns along the Black Sea sailing his boat.
I mean, I know there's not a lot of love between the U.S. and Russia right now, but will Russia help the U.S. eventually in capturing him?
So the FBI says they haven't seen any signs that Russian authorities are willing to help them find this guy and bring him to justice. Russia doesn't have an extradition treaty with the United States, so they have no obligation to bring wanted criminals into U.S. hands. So the FBI acknowledges that as long as he's in Russia, he's essentially out of reach. But they're hoping that the reward money that they've just issued, a $3 million reward, will incentivize some Russian citizens or hackers to, you know, maybe lure this guy out of Russia and into a place where he could be arrested by the FBI or some other international police force.
And the FBI top 10, is there any evidence these bounties for cyber criminals actually work to nab these fugitives?
So the FBI said that there's only been one other case where a reward for a cyber criminal has helped them arrest someone. And that was a case in the fall where they put out a $5,000 pretty small reward for a hacker living in Tijuana, Mexico. And within a month, the Tijuana police had arrested this guy, who's an American citizen, and extradited him to the United States. Aside from that, the rewards only have a certain effect. They draw attention to the case. They haven't so far yielded a lot of arrests. But the hope is, I guess, that this reward is enough, $3 million, that some really industrious computer hackers or other people might go out of their way to try to help the authorities find Bogachev.
In the meantime, Bogachev is just going to be kind of a Bond villain in the Black Sea.
Well, it's kind of amazing to think about this guy, you know, living out in the open in a beach town on the Black Sea and being free to operate and sail his boat around. And it seems like that's what's going to happen for the indefinite future.
Brian Bennett with the Los Angeles Times, thank you.
Happy to be on the show.
David Tennant, Doctor Who, you know what I'm talking about? Some of you do, anyway. Clever Scottish actor, kind of manic at times. He played the 10th Doctor in the Doctor Who series, David Tennant. But more recently, he played a game on the radio. It's a long-running BBC show called Just a Minute. And here with me in our semi-regular look at radio around the globe is the world's London connection, the BBC's Leo Hornack. Hi, Leo. Tell us about this game, Just a Minute. What is the general idea?
The idea of the show is incredibly simple, and that's probably why it's lasted so long. It's been going more than 45 years. And it's as simple as this, really. You have to speak on a randomly assigned topic for 1 minute. It doesn't sound very difficult, does it? But you must do so without repeating, without pausing, and without deviating from the topic, without changing the subject. And it is devilishly hard.
People I can hear how hard it is. Just thinking about it, it's like, I can't do that. So what was Tennant doing there? Was he a kind of big get, or they always have actors and other celebrities on the show?
No, he'd be quite a typical person. You know, someone, as you say, quite manic, quite a fast talker, a little bit hyperactive. They usually have comedians, but they often have actors. But it was the first time he has been on the show.
All right. So how did David Tennant do on Just a Minute?
Well, have a listen for yourself, Marco. What you're going to hear is you'll hear the chairman, who is himself 91, that's how long this show has been going, introducing him.
David, you're going to begin the next round. Oh. And the subject is a lovely one. Exit, pursued by a bear, starting now.
Antigonus in the third act of Shakespeare's late romance, The Winter's
So what you're
Tale.
Hearing right now is David Tennant struggling to talk without repeating, without changing the topic, and without pausing. And everyone listening is listening in for any breaches in those rules.
...used to create the image for the audience in the mind. You would imagine that bill of...
Wow. It's also a great lesson in how not to
I think it's thought to be the very first time that someone's come on the show as their first attempt and gone the full 1 minute, hit, if you like, a home run in just a minute.
So Just a Minute's been on the air for how many years, did you say?
It's been more than 45 years. I think it's 47 years. And I spoke to one of the kind of veteran producers of this show. He used to do it back in the 70s. And his name is Simon Brett. What he told me is the reason that it's been so successful for so long is its simplicity, because it's able to adapt. I mean, back in the 70s or back in the 80s, I remember as a kid, it tended to have the older generation of comedians. But it's actually a perfect fit with stand-ups. And one thing Simon Brett has said is he feels that a lot of American comics would really flourish in this format. I mean, can you imagine Robin Williams doing that? It would be absolutely fantastic. Or Billy Crystal.
Yeah, I mean, game shows often get retreads in other parts of the world. Has Just a Minute been kind of reprised anywhere else?
There is one place where it's taken on a bit of a life of its own. It used to be broadcast on the World Service until recently, and it had a cult following, I'm told, in India. And in India, it developed its own rules, and clubs were set up around the country. It was called Jamming, Just a Minute, the acronym. And it became much more fast-paced. There's far more rules. It's far more baroque and complicated. But it does sound vaguely the same.
I can't believe the host is 91. He sounds so young.
I'll take a clip of that, Marco, and send it to him. I'm sure he'd enjoy it. In fact, Marco, I've got a bit of a challenge for you. I've got my stopwatch here, and I wonder if you would like to have a go at talking on the topic of the world for 1 minute without deviating, hesitating, or repeating yourself.
Well, first of all, depends on whether you're talking about the world, the radio program, or the world, the planet. If you're talking about the world, the planet, then you must be talking about,
Have you already begun? I haven't started the timer. You can interpret
twice,
however you
and
like.
I then ummed and then I paused. I burned out at, I think, 12 seconds. The world's Leo Hornack at our BBC office in London. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This American chef knows what it takes to make the perfect Neapolitan margarita pizza.
You start with the dough that's on the bottom of your tongue, and then it goes into the tomato sauce with the basil. Then you taste that salt and the meltiness of the cheese.
Yeah, mouthwatering, but can his pie win over the locals in Naples? Find out here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, with brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program. Performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Okay, so Congress tried to mandate construction of the Keystone XL pipeline to get oil down from Canada. President Obama vetoed Congress. No surprise there, but that's far from the end of the Keystone story. House and Senate leaders say they'll try to override the veto, and even if that fails, it's still possible Obama could approve construction of the pipeline later this year. But let's get a little perspective here. With all the political maneuvering over this issue, it's easy to forget that Keystone would be just a small part of a vast infrastructure for moving petroleum around North America. John Cushman has covered that network ever since the Exxon Valdez disaster in 1989. He was with the New York Times then. Today, he's a reporter with Inside Climate News. So Jack, Keystone has in some ways come to be seen as a sort of grand linchpin by both sides on which the fate of the entire North American oil industry kind of resides. But really, how important is it?
Well, this industry doesn't rise or fall on one pipeline or one oil rig, but I think rather than seeing it as a linchpin, I would see it as a litmus test of President Obama and his commitment to taking on the climate challenges that the whole world faces. And there it's very significant.
So what will be tested with this litmus test?
It's really a contest of wills between President Obama and his environmental allies and the Republicans in Congress and their fossil fuel allies. The Republicans are determined to confront Obama's climate agenda across the board. And the environmental movement suffered their big defeat when they lost on carbon legislation early in the Obama administration. This is their attempt to recoup. And the grassroots opposition to this pipeline has really been profoundly influential in turning around and stiffening the spine of the Obama administration.
So we've got this proposal for Keystone, which would bring oil south from Canada to the U.S. We've also got proposals for lots of other new and reconfigured pipelines, including one that would bring oil from South Dakota in the U.S. to Canada. Is there anyone out there who's trying to coordinate what pipelines go where and whether there's really a need for all of them?
Well, the oil and gas industry is hardly coordinated. In terms of the pipeline safety issues, the question is that the pipeline and other infrastructure is really strained by the explosion of oil production in the United States. From the perspective of climate, the question is whether there should be a continued pell-mell investment on carbon assets that could be stranded if the world does indeed back away from carbon fuels.
Mm. Aside from the climate question, the big concern is spills. I mean, you saw Exxon Valdez, but now we've got the spate of railway disasters involving transported oil. What are the alternatives to moving this oil around?
Well, most oil that goes to refineries in the United States moves by tanker from abroad or by pipeline internally. But because of the strained capacity, there's been quite an explosion of shipment by rail. And the more you ship by rail, of course, the more likely it is that there will be rail accidents.
As far as Keystone XL goes, I mean, so much time has passed since it was proposed and the energy picture in North America has changed so much in that time. Is there still a business case for building it?
Well, certainly the pipeline company, TransCanada, remains committed to this because a big pipeline like KXL is the engine for TransCanada's cash flow. The other great beneficiary, of course, is the big oil refineries on the Gulf Coast. They were built to handle the dirtiest kind of oil. So for them, tar sands oil from Canada is just what the doctor ordered.
Jack, in the long run, do you think Keystone XL is going to get built?
You know, I couldn't possibly predict that. In the long term, the world needs to move away from fossil fuels. This is widely recognized, if not in the U.S. Congress or the oil patch. It is certainly recognized around the world. And as the world moves away from fossil fuels, that means less and less demand for oil. And it means a cleaner oil is going to be preferred over dirtier oil. So I think if Keystone is built, then the time will come when its builders and owners and operators will look at it as a mistake.
John Cushman, a reporter with Inside Climate News. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
If you want to be the best, you've got to measure yourself against the best. That's why American pizza chef Tony Gemignani likes to compete. And his category of choice, the authentic Neapolitan margherita pizza.
Every bite takes you through a journey. You know, you start with the dough that's on the bottom of your tongue, and then it goes into the tomato sauce, and it goes with the basil. Then you taste a little bit of that salt and the meltiness of the cheese. It's a pizza that's super simple, but at the same time, it's so complex.
And then you eat it. Tradition dictates that you cook the margherita in a super high temperature oven. It's a 90-second bake with an ultra-thin pizza dough that can be hard to handle. In 2007, after years of study, Gemignani put his technique to the ultimate test. He entered the World Pizza Cup in Naples, the kind of competition that the purists might say Americans should never win.
At that time, it was nearly 100 degrees in Naples. It was tented, no air conditioning, 6 wood-fired ovens that were at 900 degrees. Just imagine you being in the worst conditions ever. You're a sloppy mess. People are sliding their pizzas uncooked onto their pizza paddles, and they're falling off. There's football shapes. It's kind of chaotic. Everybody's messing up, and these are, you know, third-generation pizzaiolos. Guys have been doing it for years, and their fathers and grandfathers are watching them compete. So here comes this American guy in the middle of it. And I had my own technique of making my margarita. I let my dough rise in wood boxes. It's an old technique. You still see it around a little bit. Putting dough into a 900-degree oven, you want it to be at room temperature as close as possible. You have metal, plastic, wood. Wood is actually, if you feel it at a room temperature, it's actually room temperature. So it's an old technique I did. They're kind of making fun of me about it. My sauce had no seeds in it. I de-seeded all my sauce. The little things I did were totally different. They hated it. They really wanted me to lose. So I put it in the oven. I'm counting to myself, literally, 1 alligator, 2 alligator. I need to get this pizza out within 90 seconds. I pulled it out at 89.5. And when you drop it on your plate, the judge is supposed to look at it and push it, lift it up, put it down, and then say, go to the judges. Well, he lifted it up, and it's such a thin pizza, it bulges like in the middle. He looked at me, and he just stood there, and he wanted it to break. And it felt like it was hours. It was actually like, I would say maybe it was 15 seconds. I don't know. And then he hit it down. He pushed on. He said, "Molto bene. Well, you know, go ahead and go to the judges." So next is giudici. So you go to the judges. I have my judges. I remember this one lady. She's a leather face, I called her. She looked at my pizza. She said, "Oh, what did you make?" "American." I said, "I made a margarita." She said, "What cheese did you use?" "Mozzarella fiore latte." "So how much sugar did you put in your dough?" I said, "None." "How much oil did you put in your dough?" I said, "None." "Did you put oil on top of your dough?" So all these people are waiting to get judged behind me, and she's just drilling me. I cut the pizza, went to the table, cut the pizza, and brought it back to the judges. And we had, I think, 2 slices left. The person came back and said, "The judges want to try it one more time." So it's crazy, because when you're a judge, you try 50 or 60 or 70 pieces a day. You don't want a second bite. But automatically, okay, this must have been good. Maybe we have a shot. Me and this guy Manzo, a guy from Providence, looked at each other and said, "Wow, I wonder if we did second." We never thought first. There's no way. We just never thought first. So third place goes to, then second place goes to, and then we looked in, and Manzo said, I remember it, he says, "I didn't win. My pizza sucked." And I looked, and all of a sudden the cops came to our table, and one guy said, "Don't get excited. Like, don't get too excited." It was one of the best moments. It was a great moment that you couldn't get excited for. It was crazy because you had about 90% of people hated you. One, good friends of mine, I thought. And then you saw the genuine people that were genuinely happy for you. So I couldn't get excited. We got excited, but we had to calm down. We got escorted out, and we partied at the hotel that night.
I am jumping for joy. San Francisco-based pizza chef Tony Gemignani, he told his story to producer Alex Galifant. Want to make pizza dough like Tony, or at least try? He shared his recipe at PRI.org. The South American nation of Bolivia is home to many beautiful tourist sites. There's the gorgeous Lake Titicaca and the amazing salt flats on the Altiplano. But for thrill-seeking tourists, the main attraction is biking down what's known as El Camino de la Muerte, the Death Road. It's a winding 11,000-foot descent from snow-capped peaks to the rainforest. John Otis recently did the ride, and he joins me now. Is Death Road just hype? I mean, how dangerous is this road, really?
Well, Marco, the road was built in the 1930s. And, you know, they just had picks and shovels, so they carved this kind of rustic ribbon of a road into the side of the Andes Mountains. And it drops down 11,000 feet in about 40 miles, so there's some pretty dramatic scenery and some pretty steep cliffs. And as far as the road itself, there's so much fog and rain and mudslides that buses and cars were constantly going over the side, and there were 200 to 300 deaths per year. So by 1995, the Inter-American Development Bank actually christened this as the world's most dangerous road.
So it's kind of weird. Bolivia's got the world's most dangerous road, and what do? They turn it into a tourist attraction. Not just that, you get people to ride bicycles down it. Is this really the best idea for this road?
Well, what happened is that they built a new road in 2007, a paved highway, and that took away most of the car and bus traffic. So this old gravel road became a de facto bike path, and now you've got 25 to 30 tour companies in La Paz, in the capital, with funky names like Vertigo and Madness, and they bring thousands of bikers down the road every year. And, you know, now and again, a biker goes over the edge. There's been 21 cyclists killed along this road over the past 16 or 17 years. And wow. When we went down, my tour guide was an Australian named Mark Simon. And, you know, he said that rather than driving away business, the occasional death of a cyclist actually adds to the road's mystique and brings in more business.
You know, we rely heavily on the hype. They've all hyped it up to, you know, for the sensationalism. And we feed on that, absolutely.
So, John, you did this ride. What was it like?
Well, you know, in some ways it was rather easy because it's all downhill, so you don't have to do much pedaling. But you are squeezing your brakes all the way down. It's about a six-hour ride, so it's 6 hours of hammering on your brakes. But you have to do that to maneuver through the hairpin turns and to avoid skidding off the ledges. But even though it's a pretty dangerous road, you still get a lot of hot dogs who go too fast. You get a lot of tourists showing up who'd been out partying the night before, and they come in and they're either hungover and sometimes they're still drunk. And then you also get people who just sort of seem to have a death wish. In 2013, there was this base jumper who showed up from New Zealand. He came out on a mountain bike with a parachute strapped to his back. And he decided he was going to sort of pull an Evel Knievel on a bicycle. And so he went flying off this ramp, and the idea was to open the parachute and come floating down. But one of our guides, Gustavo Bascope, who was part of the rescue team that day, was there, and he told me that it was really ugly.
The bicycle get stuck with one of the wires of the parachute, and he crashed. He broke the wrist, and the bike hit the forehead. He was bleeding. He was alive. We rescued that guy because we had all the team for the rescue.
It's just crazy what people will do, John, I got to say. You said you were grabbing the brakes all the way down. Were your hands cramped by the end of the ride?
Yeah, you know, you didn't get much leg action, but your upper body is, you know, gets a good workout, and you kind of get what they call claw hand because you're just squeezing your brakes all the way down.
How did the other riders on your tour feel about the whole experience?
Well, you know, because it's all downhill, you get a lot of tourists showing up who don't really know much about bicycling, and they think, well, it's all downhill, so anyone can do it, even I can do it. In my group, we had some decent athletes, but we also had some people who hadn't, you know, ridden bikes very much. One of them was a diplomat from La Paz.
Yeah, I'm scared. So I'm just going to take it slow and steady, keep my eyes on the road, just like you said. But I'm excited. Yes. How about you?
So, John, how about you?
Well, we all made it to the end of the road in pretty good shape, and luckily we didn't add to the death toll of Death Road.
John, thanks for speaking with us. I'm so glad you survived this trip to tell us about it.
Thanks very much, Marco.
We dare you, double dog dare you, to watch the gut-churning attempt by a base jumper to sail off the side of Bolivia's Death Road. You've been warned. That video is at PRI.org. This is The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. If you felt a connection to those crazy cyclists we heard about a minute ago, maybe you can also relate to those dudes here in New England who go surfing in this Arctic winter weather. Not me, but in the summer, yes, waiting for waves on a beautiful Cape Cod morning with a sunrise on your back can feel like a religious experience. In Brazil, for one man, surfing was a religious experience. Guido Schaefer was a priest in training when he died surfing in 2009. Schaefer would pray on the beach with his friends before he'd go out riding the waves, and now the Catholic Church is considering him for sainthood. Eduardo Martins was a friend of Schaefer's. He was with him on the morning Schaefer died in the waters off of Rio de Janeiro.
That was the day prior to my wedding. It was May 1st, 2009. That was supposed to be my bachelor's party. I invited Mauricio, Guido's brother, and also Guido and another friend to go surfing. This was the way that I really wanted to say goodbye, you know, to singles life. Mm-hmm. And it was a perfect sunny day in Rio de Janeiro. May 1st is our Labor Day there, so it was a holiday. So Guido was out of the seminary. And we went to the beach. Waves were head high, nothing that Guido wasn't used to. And as we used to do before going to the water, we prayed together. And I caught a wave, you know, ahead of all the other guys. And when I was returning back to the outside, I saw Guido and he was drowning. So I took him outside of the water. We did the CPR, you know, for 15 minutes with the help of the lifeguards there. And it was very shocking to me because, you know, such a good friend of mine, it was hard to take that. But there were so many signals from God that I could then accept that Guido did his work on earth. And then he was then close to God, interceding for his friends and for all what Jesus wants to do here.
Yeah, it was a terrible ending for really a young man. What kind of man was Guido? Why did he like surfing?
He grew up in front of the beach at Copacabana Beach. So he used to say to, you know, his mother when he was 6, 7 years old that he would like to be a lifeguard when he grew up. And surfing is very common in Rio de Janeiro. So he became a fan of surfing at a really young age. And, you know, he discerned that he had a vocation with the church at age 25, 26. But because of his upbringing, religion was always, you know, very strong. So he was a person that it was easy to get along with, a very charismatic person with a strong leadership. So he founded prayer groups in Brazil. After a prayer group, if we wanted to go out for a pizza, you know, he would be there, happy, just hanging out with the friends. So people love to be, you know, by Guido's side.
Mm. Whether you're religious or not, there is a massive connection, as I know, with the motions of the planet and hence the universe when you're out there on the water, feeling that rhythm of the waves. Did he connect with that side of the sport?
Oh, very much, very much. Guido used to say that Jesus was really the first surfer because he was the first to walk on the water. I mean, surfing for him was a totally heavenly experience because, you know, in the water, he could feel God. He could talk to God. And in fact, I learned with him to pray before going surfing. And it was so natural. It was so, you know, the thing to do because you look at that beautiful sea in front of you and it's just, you cannot help saying thanks to God. So Guido really had that. And he liked surfing because of that, because he could feel God there. And he says that, you know, riding a tube was, you know, the perfect experience because it was like being embraced by God in the water.
So should he be a saint? I mean, he loves surfing. He felt the connection. Is he a saint? Is he worthy of sainthood?
The church is going to say that, Marco. For me, Guido is a saint because the meaning of sainthood is like being separated by God. And Guido really lived what he preached. You know, as I told you, he was a role model to me. Guido was someone very connected to the poor people because he was also a doctor. And I look at him and I see him as a star, you know, someone I can relate to and say, okay, if I want to be a true Christian, if I really want to follow Jesus, that's the person I should refer to. For me, he's a saint in that sense because he really did what God asked him to do. But being a saint, I mean, for all the world, the church is going to decide that.
Right. And the church requires proof of miracles for sainthood. So what would you point to as Guido's miracles?
Well, I really don't know any of his miracles, to tell the truth, Marco. I know about graces. And in fact, people after Guido died, you know, started going to the cemetery every 22nd of each month, because that was, you know, the day he was born. They would pray over his tomb and ask for graces, and people really got them answered. I don't know, you know, about anything specifically, but I know that, you know, he's close to Jesus, so people have like an intercessor there to help them with their needs. So, I mean, just being straight to the point, I don't know of any miracles, and I'm glad that there is this process going on, because the church is really going to investigate and decide if Guido really intercede for miracles.
Well, maybe the Pope should catch a wave, because being in the tube, that is a miracle.
Oh, yes, that's true.
Well, Eduardo Martins, thanks very much for telling us about Guido Schaefer and this this campaign to make him a saint. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, Marco.
Guido Schaefer was just 34 years old when he died. He's known in Rio as the Surfer Angel. Leaving you with a little music from Brazil's Seu Jorge now. Serendar is the name of this song from a couple of years ago. And that is Our World Today. From the World's Nan and Bill Harris Studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
Serendar, 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 na praia olhando pro mar. Serendar, 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 a praia olhando pro mar. Pescador, pega a rede e vai pescar. Jangadeiro, se apronta pra velejar. Pescador, pega a rede e vai pescar. Jangadeiro, se apronta pra velejar. Serendar, 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 Serendar. Na beira da praia, os pés na areia, com as mãos enlaçadas.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston, supported by the Ford Foundation, by PRI's New Voices Fund, whose donors include Maureen and Michael Rutgers, and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation, by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world, macfound.org, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Gruber Family Foundation, Marguerite Steed Hoffman, and the Robbins Kaplan Miller Cerisi Foundation, and by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and strengthening international peace and security at carnegie.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.